Hi, friends. Welcome to the Mindful Negotiating Virtual Space. We're going to have some conversations about why and how we came to the same field, talk about the many overlaps and shared vocabularies and tools and symbols we have, and also the different language, the dialects that we speak differently, the lenses that we use that are different, and see what you think.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We thought it might be helpful to bring some of the team members on and just have a conversation and then record it so you all could listen in and join us. Enjoy.
I didn't read all of your dissertation because I think like reading stats is just like not my, like I want to know how to, I want
brain
to understand.
Brain numbing.
Yeah, but I mean, like it's important.
But Max, if you had said you had read my whole dissertation, I would be like, I'm so sorry. So I'm glad that you haven't.
But something I am interested in talking about to the extent that you want is I'm thinking about when we were at, what's it called? The PC, where people eat on a military base in Fort Belvoir when you down, and we were talking about condiments first.
Commissary? Yeah.
Yeah, the commissary. It's some acronym. Talked about Kahneman, Tversky, and prospect theory and like loss aversion and how gain framing, I think in the negotiation space is seen as like, oh, cool, let's gain frame, but actually pretty hard. And at the same time, you introduce the idea, I think, of like a landlord tenant context where there's also this idea of like, I don't know, potentially other factors that took precedent over loss aversion versus gain framing. And so I think this is a nice place where I'd love to just ask you, can you say more about that with regards to negotiation communication?
Yeah, there are three threads I think that I want to hit on or that we're hitting on. The first, which I will earmark and we can come back to, is I remember our conversation being interesting also in terms of Tversky and Kahneman's autobiography of what brought them to study what they studied. And I remember you and I sort of, you had a very clear understanding of how you came to sort of study what you're doing. And I hadn't really done as much of that work. So I want to talk about that after this, because I think that's really interesting. Yeah. But yes, so Tversky and Kahneman, prospect theory, they talk about the fact that losses hurt more than gains gratify. And so we are willing to take more risks the further we are into losing, because that loss hurts so badly. And they looked at this, you know, through economics. So this is true of like, you know, losing $100 versus winning $100. And really what they're building on is a long history of choice theory, which I won't go into. But I was reading this and I was thinking about the ways in which a lot of how we deal with conflict is a succession of choices that is very personally and intimately connected to how we have been treated and dealt with in the past during stressful situations. And one of the things that I was thinking about is that one of the best predictors of constructive conflict is the ability to take joint responsibility. The only predictor of whether or not a couple is going to make it, have a long-standing relationship, is their ability to repair conflict. So they don't have less conflict. They may have more conflict than other couples if you were to count like frequency of conflict. That's irrelevant. The only thing that's relevant is their ability to repair. And built within that ability to repair is not just like perspective taking, emotional regulation, all of these things are really important, but also this ability to sort of have joint responsibility. So thinking about how do I get two people to a place of joint responsibility, and or how do we do that in conflict? If we know this is good, why is it so hard to do? It's so hard. Why is it so hard to do? It feels so much better to be like, by the way, this is all your fault. And if you could just like fix it and be better, everything would be fine. Yeah. And there's a lot there to unpack emotionally, which I don't go into my dissertation, but one thing that was helpful to sort out is that in every relationship, there are expectations and there are obligations that we have to one another. So if we think about our least intimate relationship, our most fleeting relationships, we can think about meeting a store clerk, right? Or going to Wawa to get a coffee. If I am checking out at Wawa and this coffee costs me $2 and I hand him a $5 bill, I expect that he'll hand me $3 back implicitly. I may not even be thinking about that expectation. I don't necessarily expect anything else. Now, if you have a worldview that he should be kind, you may expect that he says thank you, something to that extent. But the more these implicit expectations are within our relationships, the more we have the ability to be let down, right? And sometimes we don't even notice those expectations.
Yeah.
And the other and the other piece is that the more we grow in intimacy with somebody, the closer we are, the more expectations we have and the more obligations we have to that person and the more tacit they become. This is kind of a lot. Dissertation's a long piece of paper. But taking this idea that as we enter a relationship, we have expectation and obligation, right? And as we get further into those expectations and obligations, we have a harder time sorting out what they are, and then therefore dealing with the conflict that arises out of them. And so a landlord and a tenant was a helpful, it was a helpful playground to understand that it's a mutual obligation. The landlord needs me as a tenant, otherwise they're out their mortgage, and I need the landlord as a tenant, otherwise I don't have a place to live. And so it was a really clean sort of mutual need for me to look at and to say, okay, if a conflict arises and the landlord says this is all your fault or vice versa, then I can really see what's going on. And to just like spoil everything and cut to the end, what I found is that these framing, right, what Tversky and Kahneman talk about is it's not just like telling a different story. You're not just saying at the grocery store, right, we think of framing as like, this is 99% fat free, because they're framing that around something that's appealing to you to make you buy that thing. But that what actually happens when we change our language is we're not just reframing the same thing, we're actually changing, physically changing the outcome and the reality of what's happening. Yeah. And so this can be sort of best understood as like, you know, if I say that something died, that doesn't have much context to it. If I say that someone was murdered, I've now given you much more information in a different framing of perhaps the same event. And so part of what that dissertation was sorting out was, how do we use fault and responsibility as not just reframing conflict, but actually materially changing the conflict in a way that allows us, you and I, to be aligned against that thing? And the surprising finding was that it really changes our emotions, which is like the key thing, because emotions, as we know, are high when we're feeling stressed out. And all of those defenses, identity defenses, et cetera, really are put on high alert.
Are you saying that what we think and feel affects what we say and do?
Yeah, that basically I wrote 100 some pages just to say that.
No, so I didn't mean it like that. I don't know if we're talking about the same thing, so you have to tell me. But when I think about, like, there's some like Proverbs quote that's like, life and death are on the tip of the tongue. And sometimes I think about how we talk about like sticks and stones, do words matter? And this like roughly divided, either words don't matter, you can say anything to anybody, or like actually they can activate really deep wounds, like, and be incredibly constraining and evil. I think that like language could be violent in that way, because like the example that comes to mind, it's dark, but it's like a firing squad. What someone yeah. says in a certain moment is the most immediate connection, like that act, to a physical reality that ripples through families, society at large, absolutely. The world, however you conceive of it. And I think something that I struggle with, I don't know if you feel like this connects to kind of this gendered masculine negotiation versus feminine communication, whatever, which at least to me feel gendered as masculine and feminine respectively. Yeah, I'm just curious how peace builders or negotiators might frame it, because I think in the marketing, something, a theme we return to, the marketing of peace building versus the sexiness of conflict is a losing battle.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, okay, so you're touching on a lot of things. The first is famous words of Pat Benatar, we belong to the words we've both fallen under, which should have been the title of my dissertation. Maybe it'll be the title of my book one day. But that's true, right? So the words that we say to each other, or the language that I like to use a lot, is the words that we say to each other build the house that we have to live in. And so this is why holding your tongue matters. You know, it's not that you're not going to have thoughts that are hurtful. I mean, that's very human. But the ability to restrain that, or to filter that, to understand that you can't take back things that are said out loud. I like, this is what I say in my interpersonal class to students all the time. And I feel like I always, like, I end up saying this three times. So I was like, I'm going to say that again. You cannot put those words back in your mouth. And there are some words that take years to repair. And I am with our friend Sheila Heen in the camp of, like, almost nothing, I hope, is beyond restoration. But there are a lot of things that, you know, once it's out there, it's really hard to retract. Another thing that you're hitting on is linguistic determinism, which is the idea that our words shape our thoughts and vice versa. Lara Brodesky, I forget how to say her last name, but she's a great scholar who talks about linguistics and this exact question, which is, like, on the one hand, a rose by any other name would be just as sweet, right? So the name doesn't matter so much. And on the other hand, when we look at the way that language is constructed across cultures, we instantly learn a ton about what that culture is interested in, what they're oriented to, what they can pay attention to, what they can see, what they can't see, right? So she uses the example, I think, in her TED talk of, in Russian, there's like four words for blue. And Russians are actually better at distinguishing between shades of blue. And part of this is that it's directing our attention, right? And so I don't know that there's, like, a clear answer here, but I do think that it's wildly important to understand that we can change our thoughts by our language, and that our language changes our thoughts. And it's a two-way highway. I would want to get your take on this, but I would think that one of the most important ways to do that is not just hear other people talk to you differently, which I think is radically healing, but I'm curious, like, how you think that affects self-talk and the role of self-talk in all of this, and inner voice, because that's the voice you have to live with the most, you know?
How does one begin to, like, talk about, like, the many schools of thought? And, like, I'm inspired by an understanding of, like, a family system, like, based on, like, the little I understand of systems theory, to be, like, one of the most, like, liberating ideas. Because, like, when you're talking about additional words for snow or for blue and what that does to the ability to describe it, like, to me, I think about, like, figure drawing, maybe, like, to draw something, you can't just look at it, you have to see it. And you're not actually, sometimes when you start drawing it, a mistake, and I'm not a great artist, basically you draw what you think it should look like, and you're not actually looking at it. Whereas when you're actually looking at, like, the light and the dark, you're like, oh, that's what's there. That's not how I would have rendered it. But if I do it faithfully, it actually begins to merge as the thing, and it's cool. The other analogy that I really like to kind of talk about the power of words, I'm not sure if it's linguistic determinism, is something that's in Marshall Rosenberg's Nonviolent Communication. He's quoting some other psychologist, probably, who talks about, like, our limitations in describing our feelings, and how, whereas there are so many shades and iterations of feelings, that there are many notes that, like, a symphony could play, whatever, that we, like, know three notes on the bugle and they're rusty. Like, we're angry, we're like, we just don't have the knowledge. And, like, when we talk about, like, it's not really expanding a vocabulary, but to me, it's like, maybe it's affect labeling to some extent, like, literally to make the dynamic that feels large, that controls us, something that we can name, know, and then deal with. I think when I think about my conflict history, in which when you're talking about repair, I'm like, I don't think I ever saw healthy repair. In fact, I saw, like, a lot of things that happened in conflict that terrified me, which ironically lead to more conflict or less productive conflict. So I really also want to highlight what you're saying about, like, radical healing, in that I think the highest level of negotiation is to provide a corrective experience for conflict. Like, when someone when someone does something really hurtful, or I would say not skillful, plays like not the right note or something that's like really destructive, it ripples. It ripples. And through family, it gets repeated throughout families. And like, in some ways, we're actually talking about like justice and reform in terms of like, well, what is appropriate punishment? What's restorative? What is a bridge too far? Like, what is the moment at which we do fight or whatever it may be? But again, this idea of like people demonstrating what it was like for them to grow up in their family, like to give a more concrete example, something that you shared with me was super helpful in terms of this feeling of making it feel like I was disappointed with no, like an expectation that had never been announced.
Yeah. Can I give some context real quick? So Max and I had a conversation the other day, a business conversation related to stuff. And I shared with him, I said that I felt like he was disappointed in me, but I didn't know what. And I couldn't fix it because I didn't know what that feeling was. And maybe it was my own stuff, but I wanted to talk to him about it. Yeah.
Yeah. So first of all, for those taking notes, like timely raising of things is super helpful. And that was super easy for me to receive. And it was also devastating to me because I was like, oh, I know exactly what that feels like. Like, I know exactly what that feels like. And I realized like that was how my mother in particular expressed anger, is full withdrawal, full like, which also had the implicit message of it's not appropriate to show anger, which is its own separate issue. But I didn't realize how automatic I had done or demonstrated to someone else what was done to me. And so like, when we think about like cycles of like abuse and poverty, the distinction that we love to make between like victim and perpetrator, well, I guess I'm going a little bit in a different direction. It's just like hurt people to some extent. And hopefully this is like, you know, an example that was skillfully caught and hopefully responded to. But it's a good demonstration of just like an automatic behavior that communicates so much because it operated beneath the level of my awareness.
Yeah. And I think I knew that, you know, but I was like sort of to not name it felt like a disservice to both of us. And then I also remember saying to you, like, give me the chance to disappoint you or something. like even that is a kindness, to just like not keep me from that or not assume that, but to like ask for a want or a need and allow me the chance to be like, I can't meet that or something. But I think what also we're talking about is it's really hard to name some of this stuff. Like a lot of times you're just in it, and and when you feel, you know, especially people you care about, when you feel some of this, you're just sort of like, you know, what's wrong with me? Kind of is the first question. And that's why I actually think the self-talk stuff is so relevant and so important, because I think if I didn't have the self-talk to say like, Max is a kind person, he cares about me, he cares about this business, and I'm not really somebody who's like looking to like, you know, let him down. If those two things are true, then there's got to be things to figure out here, you know? I don't know how much you think self-talk is relevant there.
I mean, definitely very. I'm just thinking about like the frame of understanding joint responsibility as it relates to your dissertation. And I think like that's something implicit that automatically helps. Like it's a framing before even having the conversation that I think relates there. Self-talk is to me everything. We're negotiating with ourselves first, like the first negotiation, and you know, it's iterative biofeedback, all this stuff, feedback loops. But it's everything, like our internal voice. I mean, I think you can think of it a lot of different ways, in that like it does bring up theories of self and like interdependence and all this stuff. What I would say is that if we look at like internal family system stuff, there's like the idea that like your core self, like what you are, your essence, is perfect, good, it's curious, adventurous, courageous, all these great things. And when great stress or trauma enters, we kind of fragment and generally have three roles. One role is the exile. The exiles are like the things, the parts of us that feel great shame or have done things that we feel guilty about that we push away. We have firefighters. There are immediate responders, these automatic responses to pain or hard things, addictive behaviors, drugs, alcohol, social media, whatever the fuck. And then we have the manager, which I would say is pretty active for me. The manager is the one that's trying to control everything. It's the more prepared, longer term, like firefighter. They're not reactive, they're preparing. And so it says like, hey, don't go up to them. You'll be rejected by that group, like that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Trying to protect you in ways that actually aren't necessarily helpful. And so I think that it's nice to think.
That also, sorry, and just, that sounds very isolating too.
What does?
The like the thing that you need, right? Which is like communication, connection, repair. And then but that the internal voice or the fear, whatever it is, like exiling you from that thing.
So there is I was at a social function with someone who was about to leave because he was having a hard time, and when I went up to him, he was like, no one has talked to me. And in my head I was like, okay. And that's like typically what happens when we don't interact or initiate. And there's a large conversations about like culture and microcultures there and gender expectations. And I was just like, yeah, I can hear your internal voice. No one's talking to me, so you're having a bad time. So you look more withdrawn. The more withdrawn you are, the less approachable you look, like, et cetera, et cetera. And so there are also, I think, interesting questions about like Jung says, what resists persists. So there's also like, there's just a lot there. And I think if we talk more generally about your assumption and expectations about how your needs do or don't get met, like as you were saying with intimacy and expectations. Yeah. So internal voice, I would say, is like, for me, the reason I'm having some difficulty here is because I'm very familiar with intrusive thoughts. And for a while, I didn't know who that was. Or rather, I was so afraid of it that I actually felt like I needed to keep myself from other people because I was terrified by something that I thought was me.
Interesting. Yeah.
Which is like, I think, a pretty common thing. Like the nature of intrusive thoughts, not unlike Tourette's, and again, like I don't have formal training or anything, but what I would argue is that like obsessive compulsive disorder is looks different, like typically understood to be, you know, physical manifestations, rituals, cleaning, but it's actually like pretty devastating when people actually have it. Again, not to, there's so many other things going on in the world, but sometimes people will think that they are like someone that needs to be put away, like they might harm someone, just have intrusive thoughts. Like the nature of the intrusive thought, not unlike what is said by someone with Tourette's, is not something that's socially acceptable, like by its very definition. And you have this idea of like what resists persists. I would argue that in the anxious individual, or I'll say in myself, that people, I never knew that most people have a wide range of nuts thoughts, and that the way to think about it was just like, okay,
I'm gonna let come and go.
But they were so disturbing to me. They hit some chord. They were so disturbing to me that I couldn't let go of them. And the more I tried to get rid of them, the more they were there. And because they were sensitive topics that I didn't want to talk about because I thought I would be perceived as crazy, it was incredibly isolating. So I think we talk about like balance there.
Trust. I think something that I've taken for granted in my life is that like I trust my inner voice, and it sounds like to be in a place where that feels untrustworthy, where your own home becomes sort of uninhabitable.
Sorry, that's just like, that's the relationship to self. And to deny that that affected the way that I tried to express and respond to other people's needs and wants, right? Like, obviously, it was a central driving thing to an extent. And that has everything to do, I mean, we can talk about like generational transmission of things, epigenetics, blah, blah, blah. But until I have some awareness of the system that I'm in, how could I possibly respond positively or catch that I do something that I loathe? How could I possibly do something that I dislike in someone else, right? It's exactly what I want to avoid. But that's also how I was taught to do it. And the transmission process of like conflict awareness, emotional regulation, negotiation, education, whatever it may be, our level of awareness is pretty rough. So I think there's some skepticism I have, if I'm being honest, that like, I think that the possibility of skillful, aware people is magic in terms of what it can do. And in terms of, I don't know if this, again, this is linguistic determinism, but creates good things in the world and just solutions and elegant outcomes. But I think that we're often stuck in the double loop learning of the mindset of like, how are we thinking about what this activity is as a fight, as a public display, a display of domination, whatever it may be. And it's like pretty painful to watch people like play music badly or to put into a jujitsu space to watch white belts. And I am a white belt. It's ugly. It's ugly. And what is beautiful is to watch black belts roll, because they're like, they're capable of doing all the stuff that I think we care about as a society in terms of masculinity or whatever we want to call that, physical strength. But to watch the difference between a black belt and a white belt, you're just like, yeah, we're often in white belt spaces and it's painful.
Yeah, but it's also exciting. There's so much more growth opportunity. Yeah, I mean, I thank you for sharing all of that. Like, I think there's a lot to what you said in terms of our own filters. And I don't know that it's linguistic determinism to the extent that, you know, we can like learn to speak the language of aliens, a la the movie Arrival. But I do think that there is, which is, by the way, is the movie that made me want to do a PhD. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah, I saw the movie Arrival, and I like guessed the whole plot, which I like movies and I read scripts and stuff. So there's like some cheating there. I hadn't read the script, but I guess the whole plot in like the first 13 minutes. And then I was like, if this goes that direction, I was like, I need to be in a communication program, because I was looking at psych programs and I was looking at soc programs. And yeah, I won't spoil the movie, but I was thinking about conflict and I was thinking about how vital communication is and then how often conflict is at the mercy of miscommunication or failure to communicate. So yeah, it's what made me want to do it in communication.
Suggestion that we continue these conversations structured around like passing the ball back and forth between like showing some concept based on like a scene or a movie, like a movie that inspired us or that like rounded out the depth. Cause I definitely like, it's just so much more powerful. And I think the talking about these things in the abstract is one of its like great shortcomings. It's like, okay, well, what about what I suffer with now?
Yeah. Well, we can talk. I think we should do that with Arrival. I'll give a precursor, which is that this is a spoiler. So if you haven't seen the movie, stop listening now.
Yeah, now.
Well,
doing it.
But, you know, the idea is that as this linguist, as the scientist learns this language of this alien species, she's able to think outside of time because their language isn't restricted to linear time the way that ours is. And then because she's able to learn this language and speak in this language, she then can experience like timelessness basically. And yeah, so hot. And obviously that's the little, it's a sci-fi movie, right? But what I have learned, I guess I'll share a little bit through my family systems, is learning to speak the language of people we love does help us not only just understand better, which understanding, by the way, is its own frightening thing. To understand something to me is like terrifying, because then it's like, you know, well, what do I do with all that understanding? But that it actually can, it doesn't just help us communicate in the obvious way, but it helps us, I think, pay attention to the right things, maybe is a better way to say it. And so I'm a big believer in terms of like attunement is like, if I can speak a little bit of your language, I actually can attune some of my thoughts to yours. And I don't mean that in like a freaky, you know, I'm like witchy way. I just mean that in a like, I can have a better understanding of where you're coming from, you know? And then when, you know, whatever comes up, and this is where the family system stuff comes in, whatever comes up, I don't have to like take as personally, right? And so some of it I think is like a defense mechanism for growing up in a certain way and feeling like I needed to make sense of how adults were acting around me. And I needed to shield myself from that pain. But I think what has served me well later in life, and probably why I'm so interested in studying language and communication within conflict, is that starting to sort of like have an understanding of somebody else's language or the way they talk about things, what they pay attention to, can give us a big clue into the perspective that they have on that particular conflict. And if we believe that common ground is the precursor to constructive conflict, which most scholars would say common ground is sort of the necessary starting place, I have to know what that landscape looks like to get there, you know? Yeah, there's a lot there, but I guess part of why I think talking about conflict is important is because it is sort of setting the stage for how we even look at the thing together.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes I also think about how we romanticize or make a superpower of taking perspective in a way that I don't think we name. Like, I'm thinking about, what is this, Game of Thrones? Like, being a wog, like being able to see through.
I'm not a Game of Thrones watcher, but yeah.
That will be one of the contexts that I'll be bringing to you for your perspective.
Perfect. I want to be. I'm just like a little nervous because I am a sucker for redemption, and I've heard there's like not much redemption in it.
I think,
but I would like to watch.
I think there is.
Okay. Convince me.
Everyone, but I think there is. Just the last season people struggle with. But yeah, the way that like we don't make awesome and cool and magical, the ability for a person to name and tame a cacophony of issues in a multi-party environment, that is very, very rare. Like to have not just great leaders, but like sages, like a person that can do it with any equanimity. I think about like Thich Nhat Hanh said something about like, we talk about like, you know, Jesus walking on water or other people flying, but perhaps the greatest thing that like humans can do is to walk gracefully on earth. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think about in terms of mindful negotiating, that I'm like, I think about it as like not something that like anyone can always do, but like some music that is so beautiful, like some speech act, some skillful performance that's so beautiful that you're like, wow, that's really cool that you were able and had the presence of mind to do that.
Yeah. And by the way, so painful. You know, I feel like sometimes what we forget, and I think you even maybe said this a while back, is like never forget that the person who is offering peace is not unskilled at war. And I think there's like, you know, the ability to walk gracefully on earth means to be fallible, at risk for harm, at high risk for harm, for certain death, right? That's the only thing that's guaranteed. And that to do that and to still offer peace, and the people who I consider sort of mentors in this or heroes in this are, you know, and who are able to cultivate that sort of deep place of understanding or gratitude or empathy or whatever it is, are often the people who've like been through it, like really been in the trenches and and are not unskilled at war.
Yeah. And so that's also kind of like at least what I'm up to with jujitsu. Is trying to bring, because a black belt speaks in that way about like, you know what you should do to them if they do that? Walk away from that shit. Like that's the proper response of efficiency, of motion, of knowing like what it does to your body, like about being like, what is the actual investment? Now that doesn't mean that if we're like, and I mean, just it lines up with negotiation theory and strategy, which is like, I'm gonna open cooperatively. But if we're on the ground, like this is the next move.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this with our negotiation training. I thought about this when we were in LA working with that law firm. There, when you get into a game, right, if we want to label it that, when you get into a habit of negotiating and you are listening for moves, you are, by definition, in a reactive state. And I think a lot of what we do or what we try to do is put people into out of a reactive state into a generative or a creative state. And bringing it back to negotiation, one of the ways to do that is to say, I'm actually not going to play that game.
Yeah.
I'm not going to react. I know the moves that are offered to me and the game that's been set up, and I'm not going to choose any of those moves because I don't want to play this game. And I think in negotiation, that is very hard to do. It's very hard to walk into a car dealership when you are negotiating a car and you start getting in the back and forth of, you know, 30,000, 25,000, 29,000. It's very hard to then stop and say, how long do you think this car is going to be on your lot? I'll come back and talk to you then, right? It's really hard to interrupt that. And I think that in a more nuanced way happens with interpersonal conflict all the time. It's like, how do I interrupt this game that we've entered into that neither of us want to be playing, but is beholden to a set of reactions? It's something I'm still thinking about. I don't know that I, yeah.
My personal answer is humor.
Now, humor is a great interrupter. That's true. It's a delicate one.
It's a delicate one. It's a reset opportunity that doesn't always work. It's high risk. And I think you could also argue it's maladaptive potentially too. If a person needs to become the pacifier, we may not actually then talk about the thing because it's part of the system of avoidance.
Yeah, I think you're right. Humor is a really good one. I mean, any outside sort of like third party thing. Like, I remember one time I was in an argument with like my sister or something, and the fire alarm went off. Yeah. And then we like had to figure out how to get outside. And then we were like laughing in the cold, and it was like, whatever we're arguing about doesn't matter.
How do we do that in a macro sense in conflict zones? Is it an impromptu concert? Is it sending a symphony into conflict zones?
Yeah, it's what was that fake? It's Fire Festival. No, I don't know. That's a good question. I think another interrupter is this idea of like, I'm just not going to play the game, or I'm going to absorb the bullets, you know, like I'm not going to hit back. I think that is a fantastic interrupter if you can weather it. I think, and then not tending to it is an issue, right? So then being able to express like, by the way, this really fucking hurt and I need you to take responsibility for this. But, yeah, that's the challenge of our 10 years to figure out some more disruptors.
I had one of these conversations, and I don't know if we should go into it or not because I don't want to like pimp out my friend's struggles here. But I had a conversation in which I was totally enrolled as someone's like ex. And I felt like I could feel the shift of like, I don't know who you're talking to. But in that moment, I was like, what is the right balance of empathy and assertion here, right? Like, as someone that has seen like what the extent of just being like, fuck, sorry, like whatever, like that's, anyway, I think the first step though, and the thing that we try and say is that awareness is like 9/10 of it. Like, you can't catch something you don't see, right? I kind of think sometimes about like, if you think about like meditation, is sitting on the side of a riverbank that's flowing past and you're just watching your thoughts. It's very skillful to like catch a darting fish. Like, a lot of our assumptions or things that we do happen so automatically. And just like you're saying, Colleen, that really is also the intention behind mindful negotiating, which is the presumption that your negotiating is not mindful, right? Our negotiating is fairly automatic.
Reactive. Yeah. You had said a couple of things about like wanting something and then being afraid of that thing coming to fruition. And part of my understanding of that and you talking about that is that it comes with risk, right? Like, if it doesn't come to fruition, then it can't be, then you can't fuck it up because it's not materialized yet. And then also all of those fears about how that thing, the more you want it, you have more fears about how it could go wrong. And that if you hold tightly to those fears, they actually usually come true because the uncertainty of those fears is so overwhelming that we then make sort of self-fulfilling prophecies towards those fears. So now we're certain that it went wrong. Is that part of it?
That's definitely part of it. That like feedback patterned loop of like in a CBT model of like, I think this thing, I feel this way, I act this way. And that reinforces the whole pattern because of what I'm stuck in. And I think to some extent, like when we're talking about like refining language, we're talking about like reciting the proper incantation to like dispel ourselves from those assumptions, or to say, hey, you actually have a choice here, right? Or like, we can't necessarily tell you what to do, but step one is like, here's what you're doing. Is that what you want to be doing? Or more specifically, to what extent does that actually further your goals? But, you know, kind of like nodding to prospect theory, that also depends on your life, how you're looking at the future and like how you see things.
Yeah. And not to be back in the, you know, sci-fi field of linguistic determinism. But, you know, have you seen those things on like, I think they're probably on TikTok, but I see them on Instagram because I'm like a dinosaur and don't have TikTok because I have no self-control. But where, you know, it plays a sound and it has a bunch of words and whatever word you're focusing on, you hear in the sound. I mean, to some extent, what that is demonstrating is that our expectations do affect reality. And if our expectations are constantly these negative, anxious thoughts, not only are we wishing some of those into fruition, because like we said, not knowing is more uncomfortable, but also like it directs our attention to see confirming evidence. And here's the hopeful thing. The opposite is true. if I can, you know, work to have sort of positive forward thinking about what might go right. And Max, I have mastered this delusion like so well. And I do think it's delusional to some extent, but I don't think you can achieve much without a little bit of delusion. That we also then work towards making that come to fruition. And so I think it's like, you know, it's a double-edged sword and some of this stuff isn't controllable. It'd be nice if it was, but there is some level of like, uncertainty is so uncomfortable that we're working towards certainty to some extent that we'll never achieve. Might as well work towards a pleasant certainty.
And absolutely. I think sometimes we're engaging in self-defeating behaviors because we're more comfortable with the familiar pain than with the possibility of something else. In terms of like the discomfort of uncertainty, if there's a listener who hasn't felt it, I guess they've done studies where people like can either receive an electric shock definitely right now, or maybe like with a 50% chance, get one over the course of 15 minutes, and people would like just do it now, right? Like the idea of like psychic pain and bandwidth and all of that, whatever that interest is, it's huge. Also, just to like root in our core tools, I feel like the example of reading something and hearing that thing is very much ladder of inference. Like we're given a filter totally. And therefore that's what we select. And like, it also shows how susceptible we are to prompting or priming in terms of dropping a filter, as one of my teachers used to say, like the way in which what we say drops a filter into the conversation, maybe even dangerous rhetoric too. What if it goes well is something that is actually my deepest fear right now. What if it goes well because of maintaining and sustaining that. So there's also like a fear of loss of something that is not yet. And something that I think.
Can I just say though, just to interject and also encourage you, like, what if it goes well? Like at every step you figured it out, you know? And like, it's not fixed. It's constantly evolving and changing. And you are somebody who knows how to evolve and change with, you know?
Inshallah. a thing that I also really like, because I think it's practical, in terms of negotiating with self. And so I guess to kind of like also just kind of close the loop a little bit, I guess what we're saying with regards to internal voice is that there are likely echoes of, your parents or family or someone who's close to you in your development in your internal voice. And that we have this idea in family systems of self-differentiation, the extent to which an emotional system is separate. Or sense of self is merged versus separate. I think that's a big piece of it. And when we talk about identity, I think, I don't know the research on it, Colleen, but I think that like family dynamics play a really large role in your affiliation, both politically and religiously. And that our fundamental, I think you could argue political affiliation has a lot to do with our experience of power with our parents, like to what extent that authoritarianism is permissible, all these types of things. I really think like, the family is looked at as just like, oh, it's a smaller than community business international relations unit, but it is the fundamental unit that like teaches people how to mediate between individual and group needs before the state, before anything else.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's our family ties are so strong and they're so intricate. And you're right about religion as well. It's the best predictor of religion. Even if somebody enters into religion different than their family, once they, or they become atheist or something to that extent, once they have kids, they'll most likely go back to their what their family system was when they were younger. But, you know, my favorite thing about doing this work is that people are infinitely surprising, and they constantly are outliers, and there are people who disrupt horribly oppressive systems all the time. And sometimes that's your family system, right? Sometimes it's seeing what took place and saying that, you know, I want to work to never replicate that. And it's possible. It's completely possible to change that course. We say all the time, like, the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. And we are entirely capable of changing the course of our future at any given moment. That's like one of the most beautiful things about being alive. But okay, yeah. The other thing I want to double click on is the importance of social support, right? So if you look at the alchemy of a little bit of trauma and a lot of social support, that is a great formula for a high achieving, well functioning adult. A lot of trauma, no social support, that is a great equation for a non-functioning, devastated adult. I think, you know, your family system is the I'm sorry, that was dark, but like, your family system is the most important thing. And those around you, those social support systems are huge as well.
Yeah.
Sorry. It's a really a lot of trauma, no social support. Good luck to you. But also, it's our fault because we've failed as a nation in providing people basic social support and social services. But anyway, this isn't a political podcast.
Well, I also think I just think the distribution of resources is inherently political, even attention. So
yeah,
for whatever it's worth. I think that trauma versus like against social support, like that ratio is probably hyper predictive, like a really crucial ratio to look at. And it's why I also think that insulation is a more helpful term than privilege as it relates to loss aversion.
Yes.
Because I believe that privilege implies a taking away. It is not the best marketing. It is not the most effective way of expressing something that is very real, which I think insulation is helpful. I think about like trauma as the cold, or literally just like watch someone like standing in the winter. If they don't have a coat, or they're outside, or they don't have a home, like they are freezing. They may freeze to death. Thinking about social support as insulation, I think is helpful to be like, I hear you that you're not cold. You're not a Canada goose. This person doesn't have a shirt on.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing that up. I feel like it's something that we probably haven't talked enough about, and especially in the conflict world, could spend to talk a lot more about. It's when I worked with the Philadelphia school system a couple of years ago, and I remember, you know, we were teaching them some, we were doing conflict coaching and teaching them some of these skills, and you know, one of my girls ended up like in a really bad like fist fight at the end of the training. And it, you know, caused me to take a step away for a little bit. And part of what I've realized is that it's a tall order to ask somebody to tap into empathy, to tap into a generative brain, a positive brain, a creative brain, if none of their basic needs have been met. And it's at best negligent, and at worst a crime.
Yeah.
And that really altered the course of how I thought about conflict and conflict training, because, you know, part of what we teach is like physical violence is never okay. It's never helpful. It's always bad, hard stop. And part of what she taught me is that there are times in which it is more dangerous for her to not be perceived as a physical threat than to be perceived as one. And that doesn't necessarily mean that she should act on it, right? But I think really, I mean, it didn't, I don't know that I have any answers from this experience, but really what it did is like, exactly what you're talking about, the latter, is that even as we're doing this work and even as we're trying to see all different perspectives, we are still sitting in a particular spot. And that particular spot is directing what we're seeing in a way that if we don't very, very carefully tend to, and even when we do, can be harmful. And I think the awareness of acting benevolently, still carrying with it the chance of harm, is like something I never want to forget, right? That like, I can have the best intentions. I can be doing everything thoughtfully, carefully that I think is good, and right. harm can still happen. That doesn't mean it's my fault or et cetera, but like that piece of it, I think that's really changed the way that I think about conflict intervention specifically.
And I think this goes back to our conversation with Sheila about like the nuances and implications of blame being on a single person versus joint contribution, without saying that it's like condonable or that a person by virtue of their being is at fault, simply to say that like what I would say in like international relations is like a real perspective of realism, that like the natural state of the world is anarchy, war of every man against every man. And that life is for most people nasty, brutish, and short. Now, hopefully we've come a long way from there, but I do think that when we're having broader conversations, we're talking about like liberalism versus realism.
Yeah. Okay. But this is a fun conversation. What is your fundamental worldview? I don't think that needs to be like anarchy or, you know, bliss, but just curious.
I try and walk the walk of holding strong beliefs loosely. So it's something that I'm thinking about and have doubts about.
I like that.
And I'm a big fan of Marcus Aurelius, a person who had the most centralized power in history and wasn't corrupted by it. So I think to some extent, I believe in a decentralization of power. At the same time, I cannot fault a human being for trying to survive. Now, the extent to which they go to survive, how we defend that, how we identify a threat. But I think as much as it may not be nice or pleasant to talk about violence and really the things that I think we try and avoid within our like caste or class system, is like just really tough behavior that is crude language that, to my mind, violence is crude, destructive, inefficient language to express basic needs. Now, that's not to say that everyone has reasonable needs. Like maybe someone wants to harm another person, right? Not saying that, but I think this like anxiety we have of like, I always go back to Jung here, because you were talking about like how the people who are serene are usually the people who have been through it. And there's that like saying that Jung has about like the branches of a tree can't rise to heaven unless its roots descend to hell. Like there is some type of like unity and integration, which is why I think it's funny that we talk about integrative bargaining versus like distributive bargaining. Cause it's like, actually, I think we're talking about
the integration
of shadow self and their interest.
Yeah. I've never thought about that. Yeah.
Cause I've never been in a situation to be like, oh, look, we're integrative bargaining. Like, no, bargaining is like an inherently, like, I think, distributive thing. But anyway, yeah.
But I guess maybe part of what I'm asking is like, and I don't mean this in the biblical sense, but more in the metaphorical sense, like, do you believe that it, like all things benevolent, there is an Eden to be achieved?
I think Eden is an allegory for development and a state of perfect narcissism, which I'm not using in a negative sense, undisturbed.
I'm just smiling because you're giving me such a max answer, which I love. Continue.
It's completely undisturbed, where one looks at you fondly, center of attention, your needs are taken care of, anticipated. And I think the idea of like becoming an adult or even just naked or like sexually mature brings on all the shit, which of course has to happen. Like, so I think it's a metaphor for growth. And I also think that because I think there are different authors of those creation stories and there are two. And so I think that's the J one. I think about William Murray's like getting to yes with yourself, in which he talks about like, I think it's an Einstein quote about like, your relationship to the world is like your fundamental relationship. Like, what do I expect from the world? That affects how we walk around in it. And so I have the expectation or the sense and lived experience, which also comes with like, I'm a prisoner of my biography. So the good experiences I have in another body might not have been good. But I find that when I lead with cooperation and think about the possibility of what could be, I'm surprised and delighted. And I have learned to not assume that everyone that crosses my path has my best interest at heart. And that's a sad realization that I think, at least someone who identifies as left-leaning, I feel like That's a part of maturity that's hard to reach without categorically being like, and the bad people are them, right?
Yeah.
Or with the attempt to find certainty into like, well, what is the anxiety? How do I root out a serial killer, right? That's, I think, part of our fascination is like, well, he was good looking, he was whatever. Yeah, yeah. How do we screen out the bad actors, the people who negotiate violently in a system? And that's why I think just like the basic game theory isn't just like interesting in a removal sense, but it's like actually affects how I walk around in the world, which says I ought to lead with cooperation. And I don't mind saying that defection from that cooperation will yield defection on the other side, right?
Yeah. Yeah, Max is talking about the prisoner's dilemma, which is two people with whom, if they choose to cooperate, will have the best outcome. But if somebody chooses not to cooperate, then the next best outcome is to match that defect.
And the theory would say that it's always that there's like a Nash equilibrium. People tend to defect. That's where it's stable. In the prisoner's dilemma, it's because they can't communicate. So there's like not that opportunity. And it's also simultaneous. So
that's where again, I was going to go next. Perfect.
Very different in that this is sequential and we can back up and build rapport and trust. But the idea is that a game theory strategy would literally say, looking at reverse induction of what will they play, whatever they do, it's better for you to defect. And that I think is the fundamental phenomenon of like not knowing if the person I'm going to meet is going to stab me or hug me, should I open or close my arms? And I think when we're talking about like the bravery of some of the work that we do or that peace builders do, we're like, who are those people that like will take that knife and are like, I know because the system needs it.
Yeah. And just to like bring it back to prospect theory, to run the thread all the way through, an emotional loss hurts way more than an emotional gain. Mm. And so it's smarter for me to protect from the stab, because that's going to take a lot longer to recover from than the hug. Although, I don't know, sometimes that can be.
Sometimes hugs could be not good.
Well, I was going to say sometimes one, you have a hug that you think about for a long time, you know?
Yeah. Or is that one stab that you're like, the one that got away?
Yeah. Yeah, maybe. I think I'm a little bit like, maybe because I felt emotionally wounded so early on in life. I think I'm like a little bit like, oh, a stab, like something to tend to, like an expansion or like something to like look at and learn from. I don't know if that's just like a survival mechanism or what, but.
They say the gift is in the wound. And I think that's much more related to the emotional kind than the physical kind.
Can we talk briefly about myths of communication conflict negotiation?
Yeah.
Are there some common ideas that you consider myths that you'd like to dispel?
The myth of what negotiating is. Like literally saying, going back to our Latin etymology, nego, not otiare, leisure. It's what's not leisure. It's this stuff, the effortful, messy stuff. It's the work, whatever that means to you to some extent. And so the argument is that you're doing it. It's perpetual. You're never done, blah, 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 blah. But it is fundamentally the myth that like, if you're asking me like about this because of your salary, it's relevant. And a salary negotiation will not change your, I mean, hopefully it changes the trajectory of your life. And I know negotiation tools did for me, which is why I came to the field. But I think there's just like this idea of like, what get rich quick books are to finance, hyper tactical tips and tricks are to negotiation. And I think negotiation has earned its dubious epiphenomenal, what does this even mean? But when I'm using it, when we're talking about mindful negotiation, we're talking about conceiving of the activity of working together as not inherently distributive, not ego-based, and from a place of more abundance than scarcity.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you that negotiation isn't like a magic trick that once you have all the inside information, yeah, you could just like trick people into doing what you want. That it's a lot of work, and that in conflict specifically, it requires like a lot of what I kind of say, the phrase I use is like swallowing stones, you know, like getting over yourself, like over and over and over again. And it's just like hard work. Yeah. A couple myths of conflict that I think about: never go to bed angry. If you're angry, go to bed. get some rest. That's actually probably the best thing you can do. And what we know about anger is that it seeks for confirming evidence, and it can snowball pretty quickly. And it also releases a lot of chemicals in your brain that are thwarting your thinking. And so anger is important, and it's natural, and we should acknowledge it, but harnessing it actually does require a little bit of space. So if you're angry, go to bed. And then when you wake up and you're feeling better and you've taken a walk and you've talked to yourself, then have the conversation about what made you so angry, right? So don't, I think the piece of that of like, never go to bed angry is like, you should sort out your issues, because if you don't, they will pile up. So that piece of it, I think, is true, but the rest piece, I think, is important.
We agree. And just want to add that I think it contributes to the myth that conflict necessarily is to be resolved or can be resolved.
Yeah.
I think that's like the belief underneath it. And we can talk more about like avoidant versus attachment people in couples, and when one wants to go to bed and the other one wants to talk about it now, but you don't think it's a good idea and that nothing good happens past 2 a.m. in the morning. You should just talk about it in the morning. But so like, there's also like, how do I negotiate with people who are different, such as like, and at 8 a.m. we are going to talk about this, like for that certainty. So yeah, cool.
Yeah. Other myths of conflict.
Yeah. What are other myths? Yeah. I mean, do you want to talk about like, I mean, we've talked a lot about the connotations of negotiation, but is there anything around communication itself that you feel like is mythical?
I mean, one, this is along a similar vein to the anger stuff, but like when things are going well is actually usually when it's best to talk about the hard stuff. I think sometimes people think, there's a conflict or maybe things aren't talked about. And so time and space will resolve that. And really what the research shows is that's not true. And if something's just sort of like gone away and it's still ruminated on, even occasionally, then the best time to really bring that up or talk about it is when things are going well, to get to a place of resolve. Myths of communication. Okay, here's one. I actually think you and I were working through this a little bit, of like a myth of communication in terms of expressing wants or needs as being bad or harmful.
Yes. I think that's Freudian.
Yeah. When that is, in my opinion, a kindness.
Right. And having that reframed is everything. Yeah. I mean, I think these are good, like avoidable, like I'm thinking about like predictably irrational. And I'm thinking about like, what are the conflicts that we could avoid that aren't constructive? And I think the most painful category is people who have the intent of meeting each other's needs who are miscommunicating, where like, it's actually not that someone needs to concede, sacrifice, or change. It's simply that they don't have an understanding of the impact, and it's gapped from the intent, and the relationship isn't there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right. That is the most painful and maybe sometimes the harder conflicts to resolve. Yeah, I think another piece of that or with that is this idea that, how do I say this? Okay, that communicating is unsexy. Yes. So I think sometimes there's this idea that things that go unspoken will like result in like a sexy tension. I actually think I believed this for a long time.
Yeah.
That like part of chemistry with someone was like
just knowing
all the thing. Not knowing, the suspense of not knowing. And I am here to report that you can find really fun, sexy tension within great communication. And I think that is a myth, that this idea that if we don't communicate with each other, then, it'll come out as more exciting or more fun. And in reality, it just results in a lot of hurt, usually, and a lot of harm. And being transparent or being open or being communicative, rest assured, you will still have moments of uncertainty. You will still have tension. You will still have all of that stuff. And the communication is actually a vital piece to, I think, keeping that going.
Communication is the relationship. I think this is a really important thing to say, because it also like kind of locates this, like, I think there's a myth of and this is like super hetero and masculine perspective, I think, myth that like consent is not only unsexy, like to have to explicate it, I think you see it in movies as like made fun of, like of hyper, of anxious. Like, was this okay?
Breaking the tension. Yeah.
Beyond the point of asking for consent, it's neurotic. And I can identify with that very deeply. And yes, I don't think we have good representations of what it could look like or what it does look like in a healthy, sexy way.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Because it's not easy, it is rarely experienced. And that's where I do think experiencing like deep empathetic communication can be transformative. I can think of the times in my relationships where the other person has come to me and said like something to the effect of, I am so fucking sorry. And I totally fucked up. And the power that that has, and the difference between that and I'm sorry that I hurt you, you know, which is what we're taught. We're taught to say, take responsibility for the hurt.
Yeah.
Instead of saying, I'm sorry you're hurt, or I'm sorry, whatever. I'm sorry that I hurt you. And, but that still, there is a difference there. And the piece is care, right? That there's a care within my communication of the fact that I, in all of my goodness, still hurt you, you know? And the transformative power. I mean, my mom has said that to me before, and that just is like, that is, you know, like the ability to hear that is so restorative. And immediately it's like, well, who cares? You know, it's kind of, it just, it really changes. Yeah. It really changes. It changes a lot.
I mean, our work with JAG Corps around certain offenses, there's not always an efficiency amongst what gets doled out as a sentence versus what would be restorative to victim, alleged victim, whomever. And so, yeah, these are, I think something you're identifying that's super helpful is care as a precious resource. I think another way in which we could slam social media slash tech is that to, I think there's a word for it now called like, it's like flubbing. It's like snubbing someone with your phone, like you're talking to them and you look at your phone. I think there are just so many ways that we communicate a lack of care or presence because of the proliferation of handheld devices in social interactions. I actually think it's a minor prisoner's dilemma where people revert to the safety of like, oh, well, I wasn't left hanging. I'm just looking like at my phone as well. And the Nash equilibrium of being alone or being to oneself.
Yeah. I mean, some of what we've talked about too is like, how do I extrovert? Right. When you were talking about any creative endeavor of like drawing a figure, like how do I extrovert what is inside what I'm feeling? I remember thinking at one point when I was really young, probably too young to have this thought, but I remember thinking like if we could like cut people open and see what's swimming inside of them, like we would just be a much kinder world, like a much kinder society. And I think that work of continually trying to extrovert what's going on inside and the like with the most care, like that is what it's all about, you know? And I think then giving people the grace and the understanding to know that like that's hard work, you know, and to do that in a way that falls upon ears that hear it is even harder work. Yeah. But it's also like the only thing that keeps us alive, you know?
Dan Shapiro, who's a psychologist involved with like Harvard Program on Negotiation and other global stuff, writes Beyond Reason and a lot of stuff about like identity conflicts and interrupting them and surprising them. Talks about a simulation in which like basically the people in the simulation need to cooperate or the world is destroyed. And a lot of times the world is destroyed because they can't cooperate. And I'm like, well, we're kind of like in a simulation to some extent like that. Like that is like kind of like what we're up to, which is in conditions of uncertainty, distrust, and even animosity, can we coordinate enough to be better off together to some extent is like the basic project. And so while I understand, I understand negotiation can be abstract, to disconnect words from emotions, from tone, from policy, from like, it's part of the same project when we're talking about mindful negotiating.
Yeah, I absolutely. I'm really glad that you said that. And I feel like it's how do we like continually choose to do that is the question I've been wrestling with lately. Is like, how do we continually choose to be foolish in the face of a world that says we should protect from all the stabs, you know? Because if we're not, we're just what are we doing, you know? But it is a foolish choice to sort of continually choose cooperation and trust, especially once you've been shown otherwise.
I think for me, the finest point I can put on it is the inability to process shame constructively.
Yeah.
That's the perpetuation of violence.
And maybe pain as well. I think of unattended pain and then maybe the shame that you have around that pain or vice versa as being the root of a lot of it.
Continuing on our Latin etymology, mortified, to make dead, like that feeling of being mortified for a piece of you to feel dead. Humiliation, in the ground, of the ground, like to just be humiliated. I think injury and insult are related to insult as injury.
How do you overcome this? I feel like I'm interested in your perspective, even in working in the prisons or understanding like your own shame. What helps
what shame?
I only said that because you've talked openly about that with me. And we've talked about like the masculine and feminine sides of shame. But what is the remedy or like how do we start to remediate that?
Well, as you know, I wish I was a baller. I wish I was a little bit taller. the secret is to name it and to express it. I think shame is particularly devastating, especially like it's devastating all around. From a male perspective, so much is physical, domination centric, providing centric, again, like really safety, like core, things that put you in touch with realism potentially in some type of way. And not that doesn't happen for other people or that happens for every man. But the idea, if the code is to be strong, the most shameful thing is to admit to the shame, is for a male to talk about their abuse. Especially if it's a type of abuse that we typically associate with women. So sexual abuse in particular, males aren't going to report it because there's shame in even surfacing that itself. Like shame is, to my mind, this like really deeply destructive, toxic, corrosive thing that becomes purified by the ability to name it and the ability to express it. And so I think you kind of see people do this a lot with humor. But there's something liberating about, like, I mean, people's relationship to the shame is their own and very different. But it is, to my mind, the most immediate thing that I notice in men when we're negotiating is how shame sensitive are you in terms of like, to what extent do I need to stroke your ego and to what extent am I willing to? And that exists with all people. But I believe that gender is a spectrum. I believe many orientations and the equality of them under the law. And walking around in different bodies with different functions and expectations throughout history affects things tremendously, even when we can name them. And so for me, especially like, again, that balance between empathy and assertion is something I think about every day. Answering your question of shame, what you resist persists. So the gift is in the wound. So I think it's the ability to get closer to it compassionately, to look at it, to name it, explore it, and to become, in understanding it, more distanced and more than it, to be able to see it with perspective. And I think you'll start to notice like there's some power in that too, when you're sitting in a space where you're owning your shame, where you are, I would say, like response able. And that's another kind of conversation of like what it means to take responsibility for someone's life and the project of it. and the ability to be responsive in a way that's helpful.
Yeah, well said.
I guess I don't, but I am not sure. I think about shame as gendered. To what extent would you say that you, like, what would you call like a more feminine or female shame?
I don't know that I really think about it as gendered either, other than I think that shame for men is heavy and unnamed in a capacity that I don't think is always true for women. I think women have tremendous amounts of shame. I'm not saying that, but maybe it has to do also with the collective orientation versus individualistic orientation. If we think about the masculine as individualistic and we think about the feminine as collective, the remedy for shame is collective empowerment and collective viewing of that pain and that and dismantling of that shame. And I think if you are in an individualistic mindset where your problems are yours to fix, I just don't see a world in which you think your way out of shame, you know?
Right. Yeah, I'm really resonating with your idea of just like, if we had perfect information, if you could see, we could be avoiding a lot of these issues. So a lot of things I think about are like, what are the social setups or even atmospheres and cultures that enable the transmission of enough information and relationship for that to happen, which I think is where like we should be thinking about social engineering, which is also kind of like a weird term. But I'm also thinking about, I'm always, for the most part, referencing Dr. James Gilligan's work and what he talks about, like shame as a precondition for violence. And I kind of can't unread what he writes is that like men are typically understood to be violence objects and women are typically understood to be sex objects. And the way that we shame them is accordingly to some extent. It's communicating something in that way.
Yeah.
What we know is that women have thoughts and that men have feelings. And that is like the thing that we need to embrace is that it's Pareto suboptimal to preclude a person who wants to contribute to society, period, which also relates to like, I think some thoughts I have around prisons and restorative justice. But to some extent, I really think that when we're trying to progress, it's to understand, to see women beyond sex objects, see men beyond violence objects.
I hope that we have, but I agree with you, and the foundation of that is still being incredibly indicative of how we understand internal versus external violence, which actually I just read The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt, and he talks about this, that external violence has actually decreased if we look at statistics, even though it seems to be on the news more. But internal violence has increased, so depression, suicide, et cetera.
Yeah.
And I think that has a lot to do also with this idea of subject-object that you're talking about, is somebody who inflicts violence versus somebody who absorbs violence in the masculine and the feminine.
I think this goes back to like purpose and like our driving like goals in life. And I never really know how much like we should say about this, because it's going to be so individual and different for people in context. But it's really hard to get anywhere if you don't know where you're going. And so I just read this book called Indistractable, I thought was really good, that talks about like traction as like moving towards something and distraction as moving away from it. That predicates that you know what you're doing. And so I'm just sitting, calling with the idea of people spending 2 months doing this type of stuff, kind of like back to like tech issues, notifications, the attention economy. Attention is a resource. Care is a resource, and we are highly distracted. And part of that is because we don't know where we're going. So how could we even know if we're distracted? Because we don't have a goal. Again, that could be like my upbringing and my thoughts on the importance of goals, but I'm also with you in terms of like, if we don't aim high, we're never getting anywhere.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Mindful Negotiating Show. If you liked it, there's more. Check out our Instagram at Mindful Negotiating to stay tuned for our next episode, and send us your questions, comments, or suggestions for specific resources that would make your negotiations with yourself and with others easier to approach. You can find more information in the description and on our website at mindfulnegotiating.com. Happy negotiating.